Hey, welcome to Mystery Science Web 3000. And I'm Sean Kelly. I'm founder of WAAP.com and Wholenote.com. I do social media applications. To my left is Alice Marwick. She is a social software researcher and a PhD student at NYU, where she studies social technology and culture. To her left is Lily Cheng, who was the director of user experience for Windows and is now the director of the Creative Systems Group at Microsoft Research. And to her left is Rick Webb, who's the chief operating officer and founder of the Barbarian Group, which is an interactive marketing firm. So without further ado, I'm going to do a little montage to try to kind of prove the point that combinatorial media is when you throw a bunch of stuff together and see what sticks. So we'll watch that for a little bit, and then we will start to talk about it.
तुम जैसे सुंदरी को पाकर इंद्र अपने आप को भाग्यशाली समझता है।
छोड़ दो मुझे।
इंद्र अपनी हर इच्छा पूरी कर सकता है।
Okay. We had one little piece of technical difficulty in there, but so basically when I was thinking about this topic, I started to look around both at sort of what we do as interactive people and in our practices and day-to-day life and what we do professionally. And I started to look back to sort of stuff that I'd done when I was a kid, because I noticed that a lot of the stuff that inspires me is sort of things that I played with as a kid, or gave me that sense of play, and the kind of stuff that I like to cook up tends to be things that mash up lots of different things together in the way that I used to play as a kid. And one of my favorite things as a kid was this record called Gumdrop Follies, and it was by these two guys, Jim Kopp and Brown. I think it was Joe Brown. And basically, this was a record that folded out and had a pop-up stage on it and little characters that you could cut out. and you would listen to the music and you'd sort of play act along to the different parts as you went. And the one that I had was one of their last records, actually. I think it was made in like 65, but they've been making records since like 58 or so. And they put out about a record every year, and they completely self-produced every aspect of it. They recorded it, edited it, mastered it, actually cut the first records themselves. They lived in Hawaii, and they marketed them to very upscale toy stores. So they would take the records that they had pressed, and they would actually fly to the East Coast and sell them at like FAO Schwartz and places like that in the 50s. And they would just make their money and then fly back to Hawaii and do it all again the next year. And they basically produced some really incredible interactive music stuff, which you can't really hear anymore, unfortunately. I mean, they have them available on CD, but they don't give you the cutouts and give you the records and stuff like that. And I started looking around sort of for earlier forms of cutouts and pop-up books and things like that. And I came across the first example of the mass-produced sort of interactive toy was actually a book that was quite similar to the record that I had when I was a kid. And this was done in 1810. And it's the first mass-produced paper doll. It's a dress-up doll called Little Fanny, and it was made in England by a toy manufacturer, and it became extremely popular. They produced more and more issues of it. I showed a little bit of the interactive version that someone had scanned, and you can see Little Fanny isn't actually a doll at all. She's a disembodied head with like
so
some
Victorian.
Yeah, with a plunging neckline, actually, which is for 1810 probably pretty risque. And you could put the different, the head on different clothes and that sort of stuff. And they, in the 1811, they produced a boy's version of it. Frank Fainwell's attempts to amuse his friends on Twelfth Night exhibited in a series of characters. These are actually, you could do a whole sort of bit on, how much more exciting the and dynamic the boys' outfits are. And like, they're all, different, like serious professional things. And, he's fighting people and, doing the law and entertaining people. But basically, we got from there to here in 193 years, right? It's not that huge a jump. And there's a huge community of people who played sort of dress up online. Here's a self-made dress up kit by Anna Weasley, who's a 15-year-old girl in England, who lives pretty remarkably close to where, J&S Fuller did their first piece. And it sort of just shows you like this idea of sort of having a kit of parts and being able to combine things is something that's been around forever, but it's still an incredibly engaging experience. And it's something that, has produced, huge amounts of online revenue. Gaia Online, where the chief, thing to do is dress your character. I'll show you a little bit of my character. I only have 409 gold pieces, so I don't think, am I going to get on? Try again. And I just hit the back button. You can use my lovely browser cache to get it. Anyway, so you can see some of Guy Online. Basically the idea is my little character's over here and I'm customizing by clothes. Just the same metaphor, but essentially that's the central activity in the world. You chat, you do little quests to get gold pieces. Same thing with World of Warcraft to a certain degree. I mean, customization and decoration from a kit of parts is a pretty standard interactive metaphor, but now things are starting to change. There's Web 2.0. There's things like I showed briefly called Thirst, which does music mixing online. There are some even more interesting Creative Commons applications for things like music mixers that are coming out. Things like there's some software called Splice, which actually lets users upload their own tracks under a Creative Commons license and mix them together and share music that way. Again, it's combinatorial. So I wanted to look at the ways in which people were starting to create, different experiences by combining different kinds of media together. So I'm going to quickly sort of go down a little list of things that I had our esteemed panelists write out. And the first one is combinatorial media is bringing things together to create something new, especially silly things that make you laugh or beautiful, expressive things that would take too much effort to build from scratch. And I believe that was Lily's bit of on combinatorial media. So I wanted to ask you sort of what is it about silliness and humor and media that you think is sort of intrinsic to the way media is being produced now?
Well, I think in the past, like in the beginning of the computer, we've really thought about how it can be used for productivity. And more people are just using it for communication and self-expression. But it's still been hard, probably up until the last few years, for people to actually make their own stuff and share those with all the people that they actually care about. So we've been focusing a little bit, I mean, do work for Microsoft, but have been focusing a little bit on the real silliness of it and the beauty and the self-expression, just because I think those are going to be qualities of things that you create that are going to really change the way people think about their computers and the things that they can make. And it'll reach out to a whole new group of people that aren't necessarily creating things today, but are really just consuming things.
Right. So I'm going to show a little screen of one of your projects, and I'm going to force you to talk about it because I think it's really interesting, and it's a really interesting approach to combinatorial
software.
Sure.
This is Boku, and we started Boku after working on Vista, so it's kind of a departure. But I have a new group in Microsoft Research, and we really have been looking a lot at kids and how they play video games and are really addicted to video games. But one of the first things, you know, I have three kids that kids often want to create are video games, and then they are faced with this giant bunch of text and they have to, you know, it's just really hard for them to actually create anything. So we created this thing called Boku. Boku means I for boy in Japanese. And basically what you do is you have this environment and you just put together these little modules that kind of builds off some ideas from a thing called Logo that was developed a long time ago. So basically you can have little verbs and actions. So right now what you're programming Boku to do is to, like, basically when he sees green fruit, he kicks it, and if he sees red fruit, he eats it and moves towards it. If he sees trees, he doesn't crash into them. And if he doesn't see anything, he just wanders. So our goal is really, we just do this all on the Xbox with the controller, so we're trying not to have any typing at all and really reach kids 10 and under, with 6 kind of being our goal, so that little kids, as soon as they can play, can start taking apart games, modifying them. If you want to go to the next screen, like if I click on one of those things, it kind of pops up with a bunch of options. And this is all built on XNA, which means it runs on your PC and people can actually take the game apart itself if they're more advanced. So, you know, it's just something that we're really playing with, but we really want to experiment with how we can make building things and authoring things and modifying things and tweaking playful things more and more accessible to even people who can't read or type.
So, Alice, do you think that's going to work? You think it's going to fly?
Do I think this particular project is going to work, or do I think
based on looking at the screenshot?
Okay, well, let me give my professional opinion. No, is that a serious question?
Yeah, well, it's, no, I just wanted to figure out if you thought that for kids, you know, obviously, you know, kids who can't type, you know, are going to have a certain amount of difficulty learning how to program. What do you think about Logo and those kind of like ways that people combine different, you know, try to fool kids into learning how to program by interacting with media? Do you think it's a good idea? Or?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Since okay. my expertise on this exact area is zero, that's, okay.
I learned to type by typing Logo. I mean, when I was a kid, that was what you know, all those typing programs like Mavis Bacon and whatnot. I think
I was an addict to Mavis Bacon also.
Ruled. Went from Mavis Bacon to Logo. So
yeah, I mean,
I'd totally send my kid to that.
I mean, I do think obviously you learn by learning simple things first and then increasing complexity. So something like this that sort of lowers the barrier to entry for kids to learning how just basic processes work, I think, you know, I think it is a good idea, and it does build on sort of knowledge that they understand already, like how video games work and controllers work and hardware that's familiar to them.
One of the recurring themes I think we'll hit is that there's a lot of people out there that want to create something, but the building blocks themselves are very difficult to create, mm-hmm. you know, and even some of the examples you show with the music mixers and stuff are a little hard for people. There's a lot of creative sure. energy that's pent up on computers that people want to be able to create, like my mom, you know, and things like that. And I think all these sort of things touch on. I think it's one of the, in me trying to figure out what you were talking about with this, that was one of the things I really came up with, is building blocks for people to put together to make something new that don't necessarily, they're not musicians.
Right.
They're not game programmers or 3D modelers, but they want to play in that. They want to do stuff with that. And I think right. that's a sort of a common thread through all of this.
Cool. So let me show Quick Comic for a second. This is something that I looked at a little bit, sort of as an interesting combinatorial media form. In this, you're allowed to sort of create your own comics, and you can drag people around the screen and enter text in. The thing that I realized when I tried to use it is that I'm not like super funny at writing comics. And I want to sort of try to talk about the places where combinatorial media becomes like crowdsourcing. Like if you look at The New Yorker, they have the cartoon caption contest where they give you a blank cartoon. That's one form of media. You add your text, you combine them together. And probably most of the ones that are submitted are horrible, right? But the ones that make it into the back of the paper are genius, because
And is that because there's 10,000 of them, or do you think that there's something about being able to interact with that form that inspires enough people to contribute that they get the network effects that they're looking for? What do you think?
I think the panel that chooses them is probably a huge part of it with that. But something like this, where we all choose together, you know, like you could probably take the most popular one there, and I bet you could make it funnier. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, oh, that'd be even funnier if you changed this. And I think that's an interesting sort of new development with the website of it.
So what's the danger of that? I mean, what if we, you know, we have this site that they draw the comics, they set up sort of the context, and you just sort of try to annotate it to make it funny.
There's no danger, man.
There's no danger.
Yeah. No, I mean, I guess the theoretical danger with combinatorial media in general is that people stop making things. They lose the craft of the underpinning art, but I just don't see that happening. I see it more as like people bringing in new people that wouldn't create otherwise, you know?
Yeah. Can you show me the slide? It's on the deck. It's slide 12.
Slide 12. I'll jump ahead.
Whoa.
Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
No. Is that, not it at all.
Is that it? Is that it?
Forward.
Is that it?
That one. Okay. All right. So.
Awesome.
This is a very combinatorial
those other ones
panel.
So much more interesting than that slide.
Yeah. You'll see those later. All right. So, if we assume that everybody who uses the web is at least reading a website, I think even if we set the barrier to entry like that low, I think that's a pretty safe assumption, even if it's just, you know, their AOL start page or their, you know, Hotmail home or whatever. Then the next bar, the creating, that number is 57%, and that's based on the Pew Internet and American Life Survey, which I'm sure a few people have heard of, that said that, well, maybe not, maybe I'm the academic world.
Right, okay. Yeah.
but they surveyed American teenagers, and they found that 57% of them had created content online. American teenagers are probably one of the most engaged groups in the world in terms of creating content. So that number, I think, might be a little bit low or surprising to us if we assume that creating content includes like adding a comment to a blog. You know, it can be a very like low sort of participation activity. And when you get to the producing bar here, it's 10%. And if sites like YouTube or Wikipedia, you have less than 10% of people who use them actually uploading content. The rest of the people are just like consuming the content that others have uploaded. And then when we get down to developing things like Google Maps mashups or OpenAPI for Facebook, or Yahoo Pipes, it gets even lower. So I think that we really have to understand that even though some of these applications might look kind of cheesy and be advertisements and something that we might think of as a little simplistic, they allow people to sort of work with cultural building blocks and recombine them in ways that might be that are easy and that are accessible and that maybe would allow them to become involved in a community that they can then move more into the production or the creation sort of moving down the line.
So on that note, I'm gonna flip to something that is called the Video Masher, sponsored by Tampax Pearl. And I'm gonna show one of the pieces from the Video Masher because I just want to. I want to.
You're just trying to find a reason to show this, aren't you?
I love this. It's www.the-n.com/theclick/masher. Easy to get to.
Introducing new Always Clean, our first pattern wipe combo. Get a free sample at always.com and feel shower
this?
Clean without the shower.
I did not, but I'm good at
have a happy period. Always.
Notice that you get the ad like really quickly and then your actual content.
It doesn't load while the ad's playing, heaven forbid.
Oh, channeling your inner bitch. This is new. Interesting. Sweet.
I love you. But you don't cut class.
Big deal. Can you shut up?
That was produced by Funny Garbage, and I'll let you decide which part of their name applies to that particular thing. But they won a technical Emmy Award for this site for letting people mash up bits of content. The interface is fairly straightforward. You just drag and drop some stuff onto here, I'll load it up for you so you can see. I just noticed some really interesting sort of issues with the this works for a number of different shows, and they rotate in shows and sponsors. Then they have these things like stills, Angry Kid, Carrot Meets Man, Onion Head, Root, graphics that are, you know, things like bunny, potato, steak.
steak.
What those have to do with, I guess the Beyond the Break show is something that I'm not a big watcher of, but maybe like some people's kids are. But this sort of, you know, this kind of stuff is sort of, to me, kind of the dark side of the mashup slash, combinatorial sort of thing that's coming out now, where it's just too easy to kind of cobble a bunch of content together. And I was wondering if you,
well,
you know,
I think my chief problem with this is very much what Alice was just talking about. Like, for everyone in this room, everyone we know, this is like an iMovie interface, timeline, sound. We get all that, and it's really easy. But for that 90% over on the side, this doesn't make any sense to them, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's funny because the one I'm going to show later, the AnyFilms one, this was exactly the type of site we were trying to not make in making a sort of a combinatorial video type thing, you know? Something that was way more accessible. And I mean, the other problem is there's no narrative, which is kind of annoying, but, you know, people like that sort of thing these days, so.
Is that true, though? I think I have to wonder whether anybody actually likes this kind of thing.
No,
I mean,
they
like,
do. I mean, you know, things like Girl Talk, where it's just like 30 seconds of each thing. Like, the kids love that. It's nuts. They have, the entire generation is ADD.
Yeah. Now I feel old.
Yeah.
All right. But what do you think about sort of, you know, people sort of preemptively mashing up their content and still sort of controlling it and funneling out in little drips and drabs like this? I mean, do you think that that's likely to give way to a much more open?
Well, I'm unclear what's going on. Is this people are uploading these or it's
no, these aren't uploaded. This is just, it's all pre-rendered and you get these scenes from the show.
And these have meaning to the people that are using it in some way, right? Like they know who these characters are and there might be some pre-existing plot that they care about.
I choose to believe that they do.
Okay. Then I think that's pretty cool. I mean, if it's not making any sense to us, it's probably more a narrative issue. But if these people know this, these are interesting moments in that series and these characters, you can like make people have crushes on the wrong person and stuff. I can see that being kind of fun. I'm not really into the usability timeline thing, but I mean, I think if you cared about the show, it could be an interesting experience. It's like making your own then. That's pretty neat, you know?
Cool. Well, can I show any film?
Yeah, go ahead.
Cool.
It's .net. Yeah. Oh, two. Any films, plural.
So if you want to walk us through
this
project.
This is exactly, that sort of site was exactly our motivation. We made this was to sort of make that more accessible. You can hit go and then click the interactive films on the right.
Cool.
And we're like, Ben and I, my partner, were just thinking of our moms, basically. We're like, mom would not use a timeline. So we just came up with a grid. The six little medallions on the left there are the plot points. And then the grid on the right is the, you put things in there according to where you feel like it. It's got male and female and mystery and suspense. So if you want like underwear on a female, go female, please, on the underwear.
Oh.
So it becomes incredibly simple. Like I've sort of had this Duplo mentality to this stuff. Like marketers, you know, they want it to be easy. They want it to be accessible. So just sort of adding these plot points. So you put your own on, you watch a film, and what you realize after a while is that, you're watching a window into a much larger narrative and a much larger story than you're going to see inherently on any one of them, you know? So you watch one and it feels pretty similar to what you just saw, except for there's a little bit more, continuity. But as you watch more and more, you start to realize that there's a much bigger story, you know? Now you know this one is a target, so you know there's some sort of spy thing going on. But in other ones, it's little comedic tableaus like this scene where you don't really know necessarily what's going on.
But I recognize the little flower I threw on there.
Right.
Oh, yeah. There's the underwear.
Yeah, there's the underwear on the woman.
And
the gun.
Excellent.
Wow! Where are you going with all this?
So you can see this part right here without having seen what we just saw with the gun, and it has a totally different meaning to it. There's about, I don't know, 4,000 video clips. It was one of the most nightmarish shoots, but I think for the public, they want to put things together and they don't know anything. It becomes much more simple like that. And I really like that about it. Like, sort of letting the average person start creating stuff of their own.
So it seems like you went to a great deal of production cost and time to make enough branches or enough possible.
Oh yeah, it was miserable because it was the same budget as a regular video shoot. So, you know, we had to shoot like, I don't know, 85 minutes of footage on the average budget. I mean, it wasn't that bad. We just rented out the Hero Ballroom and shot all day with five crews and sort of did it like kind of time code style. So it's, that is, I think, a problem with combinatorial stuff in general. When you're making the content for it, you have to make a lot because you have to make enough that people have enough choices for everything, you know? So like that Nine Inch Nails one, he can put out way more tracks than he probably would normally do, you know?
Right.
So do you think that crowdsourcing and that kind of approach helps to solve that? Is there a way to intersect sort of controlled, branded content?
I would love to see people that love creating things at the back end make lots of stuff so that the masses can combine. I think if there's some sort of marketplace or tool for that. So if I was a 3D modeler, I could just model to my heart's content. And if my mom could, or my, you know, people using Boku could like use those items in the games, I think that would be really cool.
Right.
And I'm hoping it goes in that direction.
Cool. So that kind of brings me up to, you know, where is software going now that there's Web 2.0? There's a lot of combinatorial interfaces such as pipes, which we showed briefly. If you guys haven't seen this, it's pretty cool. It's sort of a kit of parts approach where the kit is really these little sources here where you get stuff off of different sites and then you figure out by adding inputs and operators and stuff like that, how to mash them up graphically. So you don't actually have to know how to program anything to get results from it. There's also another company, I think it's called Kapow, which does a similar approach. And they're actually, you have to download something and actually write something on your desktop and upload it. But once you upload it, sort of you've uploaded another little part to the kit of parts up here and people can mix them together and create outputs that they want. I mean, obviously this isn't quite as sexy as, you know, the end.com or certainly not as any films, but I think it's something that, you know, is becoming increasingly prevalent that people are starting to take combinatorial approaches to making software, both to make them easier to use and to, you know, kind of just make them more fun to explore. I mean, I played around with this for about half an hour. And as a programmer, I can sort of appreciate it. I think it's still a little bit too difficult for a regular user to use, but I think that there's some ways that they could improve that. And I think this is certainly the kind of outlook for a lot of things in the web
base of people that program a little bit here and there that get the theory that can't program in every language, you would need to do all these things. So I think there is an audience for this. You know, I really enjoy using it.
Cool. Okay, so I'm going to go to the second definition of combinatorial media. The art of creating new content from pre-existing media coming from more than one medium, sight and sound, music and commentary, words and pictures, creating something new from disparate sources. Rick, I think that was...
Oh, well, I think when I read your description, sorry, I wanted to make a point that it didn't always have to be just pure entertainment. Like something like Pipes, I think, is really interesting. And the charts one we'll talk about later. I think it's important to know that there could be tools, there could be use out of this as well. Like maybe the entertainment's a good way to draw people in. But like stuff like this, I think, is really exciting in the sense that it lets the layperson start creating useful things, you know. And so I just wanted to make the distinction between it doesn't have to be entertainment necessarily.
Right. Well, I still keep coming back to the fact that, you know, all the things over here are sort of, you know, they're corporate and they're somewhat prescribed. You know, you don't really get a lot of choices for your inputs. I can't use, you know, Craigslist over here as a source if I want to. I can't use. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, you know, what the, and I might be wrong about that. Maybe there's ways that people can expand these, but as far as I could tell that, you know, you have sort of a vanilla set of things and by combining them, you create some interesting effects. But again, the variety, you know, the history, if you look at, you know, even, you know, the paper doll, like people would put out set after set after set after set of things for people to do. And I'm just wondering, when do you think that's going to start to happen, when people are going to unlock.
She answer that one.
Well, I think there's a really big difference between like the overall rubric of participatory culture and something like combinatorial media. If we think of participatory culture as including everything from like fan films and fan edits and fan fiction to like, you know, these kind of prescribed things that are made by advertising agencies for marketing purposes. I mean, there's a really big difference between me deciding to mash up like South Park and The Simpsons and my favorite song and putting it on YouTube. Like that's probably going to get taken down or get me a cease and desist letter, right? So when we talk about digital technologies making, you know, more possibilities open, they also allow for new forms of control, like tracking and digital rights management and things like that. So I think that we have to be sort of careful of like assuming that these are some sort of like this huge social revolution that is somehow going to, you know, liberate people from like just consume, like passively consuming content, like just sitting around watching TV like a couch potato, versus creating their own content. What was the second part of your question? What was that?
It was basically, do you think that,
you know, well, it's interesting you mentioned YouTube because YouTube made their name off of copyright infringement, right?
Yeah.
That was a direct known play of theirs, is that they were going to let everything up there, you know, until they got big, and then they handed it off to someone who could afford the lawyers, really. So they grew their site off of copyright infringement, in my opinion.
I'm a little bit more pro YouTube. I mean, I love the stuff people make up there, and I think there is a thriving, vibrant community of creators on YouTube. I mean, obviously the copyright stuff drew a lot of traffic, but I don't think, you know, I mean, there are other sites like Rever that's doing perfectly well. It has no copyright infringement, you know?
Right. So you don't think that that's, I mean, I'm not suggesting by mentioning copyright infringement that it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that the whole cease and desist sort of culture that's come up, I mean, Z mentioned it in the Web Awards, that essentially every site that tries to have user-generated content as input points runs smack into this.
Well, as a marketer, that's totally why we do things like AnyFilms and the Subservient Chicken and the M&M's one. It's because we have to control that for the marketers. You know, I mean, they can't have, you know, people saying fuck on their site and all that. So giving the audience, the users, a bunch of base media that's already been cleared or rights, you know, things like that is our way around that. The end user still enjoys that. If the different tools are like, you know, they love M&Ms or they love this or that, they already care about that content, then they'll play with it happily. They don't feel the need necessarily to create everything, you know. So that's definitely why a combinatorial as opposed to user generated is, we've been doing a lot of it without knowing what it was until you told me, like, for that very reason.
Cool. Okay. One more definition. Tools and processes that let people easily and quickly combine, repurpose, remix, and share raw content streams for identity, expression, subversion, political purposes, and mostly for fun. So, Alice, that would be
Me. I think that doing things for fun is important. You know, I mean, a lot of the time we try to assume that tools have like a larger political motivation behind them or something like that. But I think that most of these are just entertainment, but they can be used for subversion, for, you know, for political use. Like we were talking earlier about the GMC Yukon tool that let people make these like little movies about the Yukon that was used by eco-activists to sort of protest like fuel consumption and SUV culture. And GMC was pretty cool because they didn't like take all those down or ban the activists from the site or anything like that. But I think that we have to look at like what is being provided to people to use as creative inputs. Like, are we just picking from an option of branded content and those are the only ways we can, for most people to express themselves? Like, MySpace, customization. Can you bring up that slide?
Sure.
I don't know which one it is, but no, it's forward. All right. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So on your left, you have like your generic MySpace profile. And then, you know, we've all been on MySpace. We all know what these look like. And at the top, maybe you have this Louis Vuitton layout, these big sparkly glitter graphics, the Gwen Stefani contact table, pick the song that you pick and the YouTube video that you pick. But, you know, on MySpace, most of this stuff like is completely, you're given a very limited set of options. I mean, most of the layouts that are out there are like celebrities or, you know, Carmen Electra in a bikini or something like that. So I think that we need to focus, I think, on giving people the ability to create under the hood more, you know, to kind of like have tools that go beyond just giving people like, here's a snippet of video content that is totally cleared.
Right. I think flipping that's why people loved MySpace to begin
with,
is because you could customize so much. Like, we could take it further, but that was proof in a lot of ways of what you're saying, because it did work really well.
Yeah. And I mean, MySpace hates their secondary market. Like the layout sites and the widgets and tools that are like, MySpace would just like nothing more than them to go away, since they're monetizing their audience in a way that MySpace isn't. But yeah, I mean, the fact that you can cut and paste HTML on MySpace is, I think, a big product differentiator over all the other 400 social networking sites.
Also, I think in some ways the fact that the design was so crappy and anarchic between each page made it feel more like a place kids would hang out, right?
Yeah.
Because kids don't hang out in like nice flashy clubs. They hang out in garages with like junk around and stuff, and they kind of make do with what they have. And I think that sense of like lawlessness or there is no authority on the site was a huge part of what made it appealing, because, you know, the consequence of that is everyone had this very sort of post-ironic pose when they're on MySpace, where you're not really revealing a lot of information. You're sort of just being ironic and kind of fronting a great deal of the parts of your character that are more cynical or more exhibitionist, but you're not really learning a lot by looking at people's profiles, because there's a consistency to that. That kind of cobbled together feel that I think after a while becomes a little bit tiresome.
That's just your age, man.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, kind of to riff off your point, we've been talking a lot about fun, and I do think that you'll see a lot of these technologies move into the enterprise or into more productive tools, and they'll be really useful. So, I mean, I work at Microsoft, and we have a lot of information in all kinds of weird databases like the HR database or, you know, Product Studio where people are building code, and, you know, and it's really hard to get one view of all the stuff about your project or, you know, the people that you're working with. And I think the web has sort of made it so now we have, you know, more ways than ever to share things and, you know, put things on a wiki and you have SharePoint and you've got some blog somewhere. And so just being able to pull all that stuff together so you have one view of the actual thing you're working on that you can use as a tool will be really valuable for people.
Show them the charts. The bottom left.
Bottom left, hang on.
This is a, I love this site. I hope it loads. Basically, this is a site sort of like Yahoo Pipes where it takes many, many data sources, and people out there in the world can combine data sources to build their own charts that tell you new, interesting information that isn't obvious. I mean, you know, they do it for fun. Some of these charts are like, you know, breast size in a city related to income or something, but you know, they're also like, it's interesting views into stuff you might like, wine and violent crime. Who knew? You know? So these are like hundreds of, they aggregate RSS feeds of data throughout the web, and then people can make these. And it's insanely fascinating. You know, I mean, there's comments, and the thanks for the ad on this site is correlation does not is not causation. Everybody says that.
What
all
a party
the time.
Pooper, man.
I know. They're always a party, but it's just, it's fun and people seem to know it. But I think it's exactly what you're saying. This is data. This is not, you know, It's not pure random entertainment. It's interesting new views into larger pictures that you may not be able to see at like the enterprise level right now. And like, this stuff is going to happen a lot more. Swivel, by the way, is the name of the site.
And I actually noticed they added this feature now called Bling, which lets you, you know, if I had a picture of somebody with a glass of wine, for example, this one.
That's so weird. They added that.
If I can get the URL, I can customize it.
It's backgrounds that relate to wine and violent crime together.
Oh. And I think other people, you add data streams and people can upload images, I think, related to it. I'm not sure about the copyright on the images, though. Might be stock or something.
Let's see.
Oh, nice loader.
We're blinging it. We're blinging it. There it is.
Oh, yeah.
Look at that.
That really adds a lot to it.
1,000 words.
So right fun there. Now.
I'm putting that chart in my next presentation. But there are some really funny ones on there. And I think this is the first thing that came to mind when Sean was telling us what we were going for. And it's just fascinating. Like,
yeah. And I think it is really a metaphor for how, you know, the major mechanism by which Web 2.0 can become more accessible too. Because right now it is a little bit of an echo chamber because you have to actually be really adept at practicing the way people import feeds, export things, maintain a blog, figure out how to manage your site. You pretty much have to know HTML. You pretty much, you know, essentially have to be aware of the larger system. And a lot of the things that are combinatorial in practice, where I put a blog roll together or I'm importing a bunch of photos for my friends, could actually be a lot easier. I mean, those are things that computers are good at doing. I think a lot of the Web 2.0 apps that I've seen, until they start to have more combinatorial interfaces on them, tend to make people like computers rather than letting them just be people.
I mean, I don't know too much about the data side of this, but if people upload the data and they're handling all the like RSS parsing and all that, and then other people get to make graphs, I think it's sort of going to what we were talking about, like, you know, novice users making graphs, more expert users dealing with the internet side.
Right. I wanted to go back just one sort of nostalgic thing that I saw when I was blazing through Alice's slides. I love that movie, is the mixtapes. And this kind of, this was something I used to do as a kid. I don't know how many people in the audience made tapes,
years?
But, you know, there was a fair use thing that let you get away with it. And I don't know of any site online, you know, that is not a peer-to-peer, you know, sort of under the radar kind of site that lets people do this anymore, that lets people package up content, you know, again, that's, they're not licensed to use. And maybe it's because it's too easy to copy things and you can distribute it.
Yeah. And it's only one medium, you know, so it gets more like sort of the DJ culture thing because it's not like, I mean, I guess with the art, is that what you're going for? Like the fact that there was like the whole cover art on the
stage. Yeah. And like,
you know,
I would write little notes to people get them back.
God,
do you like me? Check yes. Yeah. Check no.
Well, you would tell them that by the song.
Yeah. I think that there's like playlist sharing applications, and I think that
iTunes does that too.
Yeah, kind of similar. But, you know, the rise of the internet, you have behaviors like this that have always existed. I mean, it's like it's a natural human impulse to want to, like, create things and combine things. But with the internet, you get the rise of digital distribution, which means you can influence a lot more people. You can send things very easily. You have tools that are really simple. And I think you also have greater social rewards because the chance of more people seeing your content or the things that you create is much greater. And there's more communities around content creation. Which I think is, you know, when people were making like cut and paste zines, which is like the next slide.
Oh wait. Those are the days.
Yeah. Like these are great. And they were great for those of us who are like total music nerds who would actually write away for them and start pen pals with like people on the other side of the country. But that's a really tiny like subgroup.
Yeah. It was
people.
A lot of work.
Yeah. And it's a lot of work. Like creating something like this is like months of like typing and cutting and pasting and Xeroxing and going to Kinko's and trying to scam free copies and all that kind of stuff. So you do have like the
that
simplicity.
That part alone took months.
Right? Yeah. You do have like the simplicity, I think, really does afford like a much larger degree of like just a larger amounts of user practice.
It's interesting too, because like the mixes on iTunes, it seems very popular. People are still doing it, but I don't know that they listen to them. It's almost like the list is really interesting now. Mm-hmm. You know, like playlists at radio stations, they're just like, this is the list. You don't even have to listen to the hour of music anymore. It's kind of weird.
Should we take questions?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. What are we in the last 10 or 15 of our allotted time? All right. Well, let's take some questions. That would be useful because we're podcasting this to use the center mic if you're going to ask questions, and then you can be famous on the podcast. And please let us know who you are or what group you're affiliated with.
My name's Andrea Forte, and I am a researcher at Georgia Tech. So I thought it was interesting. I'm going to rewind way to the beginning of your panel. I thought it was interesting that logo was brought up, because part of what's affiliated with the whole logo, what came out of MIT and that whole group of people, is this idea of constructionism, where if you give people construction kits to build things, they're going to have powerful learning experiences. And that's exactly what you guys are talking about. So one of the interesting things about construction kits is that they constrain what you can do.
Right.
And I'm surprised that I didn't hear more of this, knowing some of the people up here. I would really like to hear more about what you think about the idea of corporations really constraining the vocabulary of self-expression in places like, for example, you know, Coke Music or
right.
these ostensibly user-generated content environments where the vocabulary really isn't user-generated.
For me, I mean, I have sort of two hats on the matter, you know, like my friends, the people here, my life, the way I live, what I use my computer for, it's maddening. I hate it. You know what I mean? I'm a musician. I own a record label. I can't stand it. But for what our audience wants, and my clients, it's a very different thing. They don't really care. They want to know. They want something easy. It's like they're sort of just dipping their toes. You know what I mean? I sort of avoid the legal side of it, like the copyright things. I think that'd be a whole separate panel. But
well, you all have the word expression in your panel.
Yeah,
so
well,
I think this is a really critical thing.
Yeah, so I mean, for you know, I feel like it's giving tools for the right level of experience and engagement.
I don't think combinatorial media means that you're not combining things that you've actually created. Your own photos, your own words that you've written, you know, your own data, your
like
own
scrapbooking
stuff. And I think that's actually where it becomes really interesting. I mean, we did this chat client years ago called VChat, and we argued for a long time, like, should we let people upload their own avatars, and will they do it? Will there be too many bitmaps? And I mean, I think we created 100, and users created like 5,000, and then they could share those. And those were so much more interesting than the ones we created. So I don't think, I mean, even though with Boku, like, we start with sort of this pre-made set of stuff, I think it's really only going to be interesting and meaningful to people when they can upload their own pictures and add their own behaviors and things like that.
I mean, that was the distinction I was trying to make. Maybe I didn't make it clear enough between larger participatory culture and combinatorial media. I think that they're, I mean, Andrea, you know, I totally agree with you on this. Like, I think that limiting, the other point I was trying to make about MySpace customization is that you're really seeing an option of choices that are very branded, that are very commercial, that are very focused on a certain kind of self-expression that might be about like displaying brands and movie stars and musicians that you're affiliated with, but not maybe about displaying your political beliefs or your religious beliefs or your sociocultural like location or something like that. So, I mean, I think that you know, I think that with these combinatorial media things, to me, what's positive about them is that they lower the barrier to entry, because it's all well and good for us to say, we think everyone should be creating their own, like, fan films and posting them to YouTube. And I would love to see, like, everybody in the world, like, having access to the tools to make, like, really great creative products that allow them full self-expression. But I think that in terms of, like, access to knowledge, access to technology, we're just not at that point. So if some of these tools allow people to start getting used to the idea of building, and then they can then take that knowledge and use it to express themselves in ways that are more native and less maybe constrained and bounded by what corporations allow people to use, because it protects their brand in some way. I think that there is some value to that. Although,
I mean, implicit in the entire discussion is we are secretly plotting to get everyone creatively engaged. And absolutely. What I mean? But you need to give them the steps to get along the way, I think.
Yeah.
Especially with brands. I mean, I face the reality of it every day. We take it as far as they let us. And after that, you know, that's next year. Working on that part, though.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dave Todd from iSpot.com. We're an online video mashup and mobile distribution platform. And we face exactly what you're talking about all the time. We started out as a completely open platform and still are. You can download any piece of media. You can edit anything that anybody has made public. But we're increasingly working with marketers and branded folks who want more, quote, control. But I wanted to go back to what she was saying about constraining people maybe being bad, and I totally agree with what you just said as far as it. I think of us as an entry, as like a gateway drug, right? We're the pot that's going to get you to the heroin. Maybe you'll go to Final Cut Pro eventually, but we let many, many more people actually engage with content and make something in a very simple drag and drop way, but one of the interesting things that we found is that cutting things up into bite-sized chunks for them and giving them sort of a kit to play with has, engaged hundreds or thousands more people. Because if you give somebody a music video that's been edited by somebody for $50,000 or a movie trailer that Paramount spent $200,000 doing, it's going to be really hard to make it better. But if you cut up, action scenes or things based on themes or whatever and put these things out there, people are much more likely to say, hey, I can take that and do something and look how easy it is and I'm going to share it. And the second thing I'll say about our corporate clients is it's interesting. They all start out wanting control. We're doing the NBA highlight mixer. And, it's really popular.
Right,
2,000 people a day are joining. They're making their mixes. They're adding music to it. And the NBA didn't want to allow embeds. Well, so now they're going to allow embeds. They're going to start adding user-generated content.
Well, I mean, I think
it's just interesting that they need to be led.
Well,
right.
they know, what I mean? There's this thing that they're all scared. They're all control freaks. I mean, I talk to these guys every day. They're sitting there fighting with their lawyers for years. I know the man behind that NBA video thing, and I know that he fought for 3 years just to be allowed to do it,
Right.
Eventually quit because he gets fed up. I mean, there are people in these companies that would love to give you more conversation and control, but they got lawyers. They have 500 lawyers that approve everything. I'm working on a social network now for a brand, and it's like their lawyers' brains are exploding. They literally don't know how to approve it. They ask for printouts of every page. The marketers are very smart, but they're like, oh, we got to get printouts. We did a Red Stripes site where I had to print out 700 pages to give the lawyer so he could approve the copy. It was just, I could have just given him an XML file, but they do know. They're not like completely control freaks. They want to talk. I mean, that's their whole existence is to talk to us.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Hi, I'm Marshall Kirkpatrick. I work with Splashcast Media. We're a mixed media syndication platform. I just wanted to quickly make sure that anybody who's interested here knows about Representative Mike Doyle's statement on the House of the U.S. Congress on Friday when he gave a 3-minute statement in defense of DJ Drama and Girl Talk.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, really neat statement. And if you're interested in seeing that 3 minutes, we've got it up at tinyearl.com/23 23JNVA.
It's not that catchy. Tiny.
So, yeah, I know. I wish you could put that at the end. But, yeah, so I won't pretend to have a question. But
no, but that's cool that somebody's – because, I mean, that's the thing we think about a lot is that the law just is not paying attention. Girl Talk specifically, I've been really fascinated in. And, you know, it happens even like when you go to Vegas and you go to the Bellagio, they're playing songs for like a minute each now. And I mean, that's just what is happening and people refuse to acknowledge it, you know? I mean, not refuse. There's no conspiracy in it.
Do we have time for one more? Great.
Hi, I'm Robin Benefield with DiscoveryChannel.com. As someone that's worked in this corporate medium, I mean, it is exactly what you're saying. I mean, you're kind of hamstrung. And half the time you can't use the video in your own vast library because it's been done by someone else and there's all kinds of legal restrictions. So, but we are very much, looking at this kind of mashup, field and pieces and want to be able to use this kind of stuff on our site. And really our goal is just to kind of empower our own fans to be able to interact more with the things that they love on our network. So, one thing I wanted to ask about any films, is, have you done that with other corporations where you've actually created a piece that kind of fits with their brand but might not necessarily be using any of their materials that kind of allows people to interact on the same basic theme or you know, fitting within that brand but not using their materials?
Some, but our revolution in video interactivity was really derailed by YouTube in a lot of way. A lot of marketers sort of, they were so excited about video, but now they just feel like they can put their spots on YouTube. So like the market's all sort of fallen out of fun video mashups on the branding side right now. But yes, absolutely. And so that sort of stuff is the sort of thing we'd love to do more of, you know.
Great panel, by the way. And I like that game for six-year-olds. My six-year-old nephew could really get into that. I want to ask kind of a question about copyright, and I know it's not really that important, ultimately. there is, you know, I think the naive view of mashups and, you know, recombining things. People started in high school. They don't have any sense of what copyright restrictions they have. And then suddenly they hit a brick wall where they find out, well, you know, their video can't include the music by U2 or whatever. And I was wondering if, do you think that copyright is going to get stricter about this, or is it going to loosen up?
I mean, it's my hope that copyright law changes to kind of, I mean, copyright laws as we have them today were built before this kind of media existed. I mean, and the truth is, like, who owns the copyright for the thing that you mashed up if it, you know, combines all these different pieces of media from different places? And I mean, I would expect some people will want to be able to own the right, you know, they'll be like almost like DJs who create these mixes of things that they'll want to make some money off of or whatever. But I don't think the laws necessarily, I mean, they're just hard to understand what you're even supposed to do if you're making this kind of media.
I think it'll catch up a little bit. I mean, the derivative work is enshrined in our belief of copyright, and it's sort of being ignored right now.
And that's a 30-year-old concept. I mean,
yeah, it's been there. We accept the idea of the derivative work. It's just not working.
And by the way, I don't accept it, but go on.
Well, I mean, it's in, you know, copyright law accepts it. And I think, like, when you look at, like, film was a perfect example. When they started, they're like, oh, we need music. And then now we have very, very robust, well-defined laws on the use of soundtracks and pre-published music and albums or in movies that are exceptions. Like, the soundtrack is not considered part of the work for hire when you engage people for a film. Like, they've worked it out, you know. And I think we're, 5 years in? I feel pretty confident. I mean,
I think that the fair use exemption is something that really has been chipped away, or people aren't really aware of it. I think that the sort of chilling effects of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and of cease and desist letters makes a lot of people just not want to, you know, they, like, you know, for people who actually own brand content, I think that there's, you know, going after like a 15-year-old who's writing fan fiction or has like a, you know, a Battlestar Galactica fan site or something. Like, there might be fair use there. Like, somebody might actually be engaging with the works in a way that's completely legal. But if the parent company of the brand or the wants to send a cease and desist letter, that person's ISP is going to force them to remove the content, and that person is probably going to back down.
Well, and they don't know.
Yeah,
you know
they don't
I mean?
Know. They don't have the legal resources available to wrangle with a multinational media corporation.
I mean,
so,
people that have invested interest in fair use, like Google, should be fighting a lot more actively
there,
for it.
There know? Needs to be a understanding of people who are doing like entertainment content mashups and fan fiction and stuff like this. Henry Jenkins said this yesterday in his talk. Like, we need to start advocating for those people, organizations like the EFF or organizations that are working on digital freedom or free culture issues, because this, you know, the media companies are always going to try to claim complete ownership of every single use of their brand, but that's not legally what, you know, that isn't the actual legal precedent. So,
okay, I'll sit down after I make this one comment. You know, I'm a big proponent of Creative Commons and all, and my hope is that Creative Commons becomes more influential as, you know, copyright controls become, you know, more in your face. However, when you look at MySpace, you don't really see people, you know, Googling things to make sure these images or these videos or what are Creative Commons friendly. They're just putting the same old stuff that we get on crap TV and, you know, from iTunes. So,
well, I mean, for me, this sounds so embarrassing at this conference, but I feel like advertising will help a lot of that. We watch TV for free. We listen to the radio for free, and the advertising has been paying for this. So we've developed a mentality that it's free. And I think they need to step up on the interactive side and work it out again for us. You know, it's terrible that I expect them to save anything, but
I just wanted to throw something out on the fair use issue. So there's a woman, and she's amazing. She's so amazing that I can't remember her name, but she did a study over about a 4-year period working with independent filmmakers who make things like for Nova or PBS or whatever. So it was a little bit different than like somebody mashing up on the web, but if you Google for fair use and Film Arts Foundation, San Francisco, and study, I think it will just pop right up. And basically what she did is she was looking for, when judges make that decision about what's fair use, they often look for social norms. And so if a lot of filmmakers do something, and it's very common, and there's documentation about it, and that's why they did the study, so the documentation would exist because it didn't exist before, then they'll take that and when some media company comes along and says, you know, no, you can't use that ambient music of maybe U2 in the background for 30 seconds that was happened to be, you know, playing on the right street while you were walking along and filming. Yes, you can. And so I think it applies for all of us who make mashups on the web that as well. And I would definitely recommend grabbing that. Read through it really carefully. It's written for people who actually make films versus for lawyers, and it's great.
Yeah.
I just can't remember the.
The important distinction, though, is that documentaries have a little bit more leeway, so just like the news, just like we could see the Pam Anderson sex tape because it was news. You know what I mean? It's true. Like, if you're making entertainment film, it's a lot more restrictive. But I think for social good.
But what she did, okay, so she did start with documentary people, but she actually covered a lot of narrative as well. And there are a lot of reasons in narrative, commentary, and parody. In
yes.
narrative storytelling that are an extremely important part of fair use. And we keep using these digital mechanisms to edge out fair use. And it's so draconian. I mean, like the Audible tools that are being used right now by MySpace and YouTube to pull clips off mm-hmm. of those sites don't care about fair use because mm-hmm. they're mechanical. Mm-hmm. They just trample all over fair use. And so I think it's really important for people to be really sort of up on what it means to engage in fair use. And
yeah.
I would really recommend that document.
For me, one of the analogies was the whole period of, I just remember watching the A-Team when I was a kid and they had whited out the word Pepsi on the Pepsi machine. And I was like, what is that? Why do brands never, these things that we love in our lives aren't in movies. It was never illegal. They never had to pay. They just were all afraid to do it. You know what I mean? And one day one guy did it. And then 1 year later, there was a robust product placement marketplace and it was completely revolutionized just because people were like, hey, let's give it a shot.
There's also the question of scale. I know, Alex, you talked about sort of the concept of the micro celebrity, and there's fair use. There's a scale and an audience size component to it too, and that isn't being addressed either. I mean, something may be fair use for the first 30 people and not for the next 30,000, and that's something that you know, computers are really good at. We know how many people are listening to these things, and instead of, you know, applying a blanket policy, it would be interesting to see if, you know, people actually reasserted the guidelines for fair use for you know, things like public performance and stuff like that, where they actually measure the size of the audience. It'd be pretty easy to do that online. But for some reason that isn't really paid attention to very much.
I think it's a defense a lot of the times. But I was just saying, I think it's a defense you could use a lot of the time. Like, look, only 30 people saw this, you know?
Right. Are we out of time? Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thanks very much, guys, for coming.